listening to the ACOG District 2 podcast series, Let's Connect, where we create connections with our patients, our communities, and each other.
So hello, I am Dr. Camille Claire, past chair of ACOG District 2, and I'm pleased to welcome you to this podcast on why colorectal cancer screening is important for OBGYN practice. So before we get started, just a quick reminder, this podcast does not substitute for medical advice from your independent physician, and patients are encouraged to talk to their doctor about their individual health needs. And we ask you to please take a few minutes to complete a brief questionnaire or evaluation at the conclusion of this podcast, and the link to the evaluation can be found in the description. Now let's get started. So just a little bit about my involvement in this work. I'm an OBGYN in practice in Central Brooklyn, and I did research on colorectal cancer screening because I saw that for many of us in practice, it was not really clear like how we should be screening our patients, what we should be doing, how it impacts our practice. So in our study that we did, we found that many residents were actually very, very aware of current screening practices and were very attuned to it, but our faculty colleagues were not so attuned to it throughout the country. And so this is how it came to us to do this work. So we're pleased to release this podcast during March, which is Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month. And I'm joined today by three colleagues. First, Ms. Michelle Dedea, Associate Director of the Cancer Center Partnerships at the American Cancer Society. Also, Dr. Renee Williams, a gastroenterologist who's professor in the Department of Medicine at NYU Langone and Associate Chair for Health Equity. And Dr. Mary Rosser, Director of Integrated Women's Health. And the Richard Yu and Ellen J. Levine, Assistant Professor of Women's Health in Obstetrics and Gynecology at Columbia University Irvine's Medical Center, and she's also chair-elect of ACOG District 2. Thanks to everyone for joining us today. So let's dive right into the data and really answer the question of why. Why is this important for OBGYNs to screen for colorectal cancer when there's so many things on our plate? We have a lot of issues in our practices to deal with. So Michelle, I'm going to kick it over to you. Can you share with us some trends that you're seeing in colorectal cancer in your work?
Absolutely. Thank you, Dr. Claire. I am happy to be part of this conversation and to share some highlights from the American Cancer Society's recently released annual report, Cancer Facts and Figures for 2024. First, 1 in 25 women will be diagnosed with colorectal cancer in their lifetime. And it is estimated that there will be more than 71,000 new cases amongst women with colorectal cancer in 2024. And that incidence is estimated to be higher among Black women.
Wow, that's incredible. 1 in 25? That's staggering.
Yeah, it really is. And while deaths from colorectal cancer have declined over the years, due in part to early detection through screening, unfortunately, according to the latest American Cancer Society data, colorectal cancer is now the second leading cause of cancer deaths among women under 50 years of age.
So that's incredible. So colorectal cancer is really getting more prevalent in those that are younger. So, which is why it's so important really for us to adhere to these new guidelines to screen women who are at average risk starting at age 45. Is that right?
Yes, it absolutely is. Increasing uptake of screening in women 45 to 49 years old, including colonoscopy and enhanced awareness of convenient, non-invasive stool tests, can help reverse this trend. Additionally, up to 1/3 of people diagnosed before 50 years of age have a family history or a genetic predisposition and should begin screening before age 45. As we know, colorectal cancer screening saves lives. In New York, we are 7th highest in colon cancer screening rates overall out of 50 states. However, in all states, screening is substantially lower in people ages 45 to 54 years old.
So that's really a call for action for OBGYNs to think about counseling our patients on screening options for colorectal cancer. So I'm going to pass it on over to Dr. Williams, who's a gastroenterologist here in practice in New York. Can you share your experiences from your practice, what these statistics really mean that Michelle has shared with us? How do they resonate with you in your practice?
I think one of the things that's become very prominent is early onset colorectal cancer. We're seeing people under the age of 50 coming in with higher incidences and where they're dying from colon cancer. And it's staggering. And the sad part is we just don't know why. There's a lot of research that's currently happening within that area. However, the great news is in people over the age of 50, we've seen a decrease in incidence and mortality. Specifically speaking, we know from research that polypectomy, one of our major studies from, I think, 1990s or early 1990s, followed patients for 23 years and found a reduction in mortality from colon cancer. More stool-based testing, such as the fecal occult blood testing and the fecal immunochemical testing, we've done studies that shows, again, a decrease in mortality from CRC. So we know screening saves lives. So it's really important. I think, unfortunately, what we are still seeing is inequities or disparities in screening rates. Patients from marginalized communities are not screening at the same rate, and some data shows that certain patients from certain groups are not getting recommended for screening. So that's still a big issue for our field as a whole to really tackle over time.
You talked about the different screening options. Can you break those down a little bit more for our audience?
There is a menu you can look at. I think depending on what you're looking, American Cancer Society has their recommendations. The United States Preventive Task Force has their recommendations. The GI Societies have their recommendations. It's a whole menu, but I'll go over the more basic ones. So colonoscopy, that's a preference. I'm a gastroenterologist, of course. I'm going to say get a colonoscopy. That being said, the best test is the test that gets done. It's a test that's diagnostic and also we can do therapy. So if we see a polyp, we can take it out. We do polypectomies at that same time. And that's the best test, I think, overall, because we can see and we can intervene at the same time. The other options patients have, and some patients may prefer, is stool-based testing. So in looking at your choices, there are two types of stool-based testing that are very common. There's a fecal immunochemical test, which is called a FIT test. And there's also the FIT DNA, which is known as Cologuard. The FIT test by itself is an immunoassay specific to human hemoglobin. And a great thing about this test is there's no dietary restriction. And the pool sensitivity is about 75%, looking across multiple studies, with a specificity of like 90 to 91%. The fecal DNA test or FIT DNA test, it's called the Cologuard test, has a little bit better sensitivity and about equivalent specificity. So those are the two things that you can offer to your patients, and they're both covered by insurance. So the difference between the two is that for FIT testing, we normally repeat on a yearly basis. The FIT DNA or Cologuard is every 3 years if it's negative. But if any of these tests are positive, we do want to have a timely colonoscopy, and we recommend a colonoscopy within 3 months of a positive test.
Well, thanks for that explanation. You really drew it out for us who's eligible for what tests and what makes sense. So I don't know if Dr. Rosser, you wanted to jump in here as you're talking to your patients in your practice. What are you seeing and how are you talking to them about some of those screening options?
Thank you so much, Dr. Claire. I appreciate being part of this group today. So when people come in for their annual GYN exam, we like to assess their risk and any symptoms for GI issues as well as other issues. And we look, you know, we ask questions like, do you have blood in your stool? Has your stool changed? And have you had any abdominal pain? We also assess the woman that comes in with pelvic pain because a lot of times those symptoms of pelvic pain can mimic symptoms that we see with any kind of GI issues. So we are very attentive to that. We talk to everybody during their annual visit about the times for screening, that the new 50 is really 45, unless there is a personal history of cancer or a family history of colon cancer. And we also ask if they've had any genetic testing and if they would like genetic testing. So we do that in the office, and then we broadly explain the types of screening that Dr. Williams just reviewed, and then we will refer directly to a gastroenterologist.
All right. So Dr. Rosser, as you're talking to your patients about screening options, and it's so important to have this conversation in our practice, can you talk to us a little bit about some of the risk factors that you found are important to talk to patients about in your practice?
We think about risk factors on two different levels, really. First of all, we look at individual risk factors such as family history, for example, first degree relative with colon cancer or multiple relatives with colon cancer. We look at risk due to diseases of chronic inflammation such as inflammatory bowel disease, ulcerative colitis, Crohn's disease, a history of adenomatous polyps, or a personal history of other cancers, as well as type 2 diabetes. Now, we also take into account an individual's lifestyle risk factors, and this includes being overweight or obese, decreased in physical activity, increase in a diet high in fat, such as red meat, alcohol, smoking, and a lack of fruits and vegetables.
So So that's key in your history taking, right? As we're talking to our patients, that should come out in our history taking for sure.
Yes. And I'll refer to Dr. Williams to see if there is an addition to the list.
The only thing I would say is for anyone who has a personal history of colon cancer or family members or family history of colon cancer or a history of adenomatous polyps, and they should get a colonoscopy. They shouldn't get any other form of colon cancer screening. Those people get colonoscopies.
That's a good point. Thank you so much. What about insurance issues? Many of my patients may have concerns about insurance coverage. And how do you talk to your patients about those issues in your practice?
So insurance coverage for colon cancer screening is pretty good, actually. And they can review their insurance pamphlets and look at that and what the ages that they will allow screening. But I think that the insurance carriers now, both public and private, are pretty good at covering screening for colon cancer, and certainly if there's an issue.
So something to note also, so in the past, if you had a colon cancer or colonoscopy done, you had a polypectomy, it was changed to a diagnostic test and the patient would get charged. That cost sharing has now gone away. So if you have a colonoscopy done and you have a polypectomy done, it's covered. And most insurances cover the stool-based testing.
Fantastic. And so Dr. Williams, just expound upon those inequities that you talked about and the differences that continue to exist in colorectal cancer screening. Can you expound a little bit more about those inequities and disparities in colorectal cancer, particularly for Black patients?
So it's interesting. So if you're looking at the incidence of colon cancer, as of the data for the last 2 years, the highest incidence we're now seeing in Alaskan Native American Indians, and then number two is Black Americans. Whereas in the past, it was or Black men. But if you're looking at mortality, Black men have the highest mortality. Again, this is reflected if you're looking at women. You have the highest mortality in Alaskan Native American Indian women and also Black females, and a higher incidence in those groups. And we know it's multifactorial. I think in medicine, we're now recognizing the great impact those social determinants of health really have on our health outcomes. They think 40 to 50% of health inequities are due to, you know, health behaviors, living in areas that have high social vulnerability indexes. I think the term we're using right now is your zip code is more important than your genetic code.
Absolutely.
And when it comes to your health outcomes, think of someone who's living in an area that is vulnerable. There's not a lot of health-promoting behaviors. Access to physicians may be challenging. Looking at access to healthy food or non-nutritious foods, we're calling them food swamps, meaning you have a high rate of non-nutritious foods. Based on those social determinants of health, all those risk factors are present in those neighborhoods. So we're recognizing that those are making a big difference. And we have to really start mitigating transportation issues and economic instability. So I think these inequities that we see are playing out on a much larger field.
So those programs that you talked about, I guess, addressing those social determinants, is that what you've used in your practices to kind of mitigate those disparities among the patients that you've seen?
It's hard. So I work in a city. I work for NYU Langone Health, but my clinical site is Bellevue Hospital Center, and it's a safety net hospital. So I think within my own practice, within our hospital system, we have certain things to help patients. For patients who don't have insurance, there's a sliding scale in terms of paying for the colonoscopy itself. So it becomes very, very affordable. And we also offer metro cars for transportation issues. So there are little things that can be done. But I'm going to discuss C5 at a later point in this podcast and what was done on a very citywide level that made a huge difference in screening rates. That being said, COVID hit and everything kind of unfortunately went back down.
Understood. So Dr. Rosser, you know, you mentioned how things are for you as an OBGYN in your practice. And so how do you introduce that conversation about colorectal cancer screening with your patients? And why should we, our listening audience that are primarily OBGYNs, why should we really, you know, take part in this screening? We're very good at cervical cancer screening, excellent at breast cancer screening, colorectal cancer screening. We're learning a lot from just this podcast alone. Can you talk to me about how we should address that for our patients?
Oh, absolutely. I love to take a holistic approach to see women. And why not us as OBGYNs? We are in that unique position. We see this in every publication that we see introducing new ways of screening and prevention. We treat more than 50% of the population, so it really is a responsibility for us to bring this up. The key is to increase the screening rate, right? So therefore, we need to have the conversation with patients, we need to normalize it, and we need to keep repeating the message. Colon cancer, as we have said, is the second leading cause of cancer death among women under 50. And so I feel that as OBGYNs, we are often the primary care physician for many of our patients, especially those less than 50 who may not have any chronic medical conditions at that time. It's critical that we incorporate colon cancer screening conversation into our practice for every single patient. Inequities and disparities continue to exist, and it is really up to us to be a part of changing the narratives in women's healthcare. I bring it up at every well woman visit starting at 40 or higher. And as I said earlier, I talk to every single patient, regardless of age, 18 to 90 and higher, about any symptoms that they may have with regard to their GI tract.
It sounds like you kind of fit it in almost in every single visit. You start to bring that up right away for patients in your practice because there's so much that we have to think about, right? We have so much in terms of patient-centered care to focus on. So it sounds like for you, Dr. Ross, you kind of bring it up all the time. You fit it easily into your conversation. But any other advice or anything else you want to add for those of us who maybe it may not be as seamless that we fit it in. I don't know if you wanted to add anything about that.
Well, I always think that our bodies are not in silos. And sometimes we all as physicians, and it's because we know our specialty so well, but sometimes we forget that there are other organs in our bodies. And so I try to approach it that way and try to approach it that way to patients. And I would urge other people to think about it. It does not take a lot of time to incorporate this into your discussion while you're talking to and examining the patient. It does not take a lot of time. And, you know, really that vague GI symptoms may overlap with GYN symptoms. And so we have to keep that in mind when we're looking at the whole person.
And then what about referrals? You know, the referral pathway can be kind of tricky. Any advice to our colleagues about how do you handle those referral patterns? And Dr. Williams, let us know if there's anything, if when Dr. Rosser's finished talking, if you wanted to add anything about how you see our colleagues sending referrals to yourself, that'd be great.
So yeah, that's a great question. I network and network and network, and then I navigate. So part of our patient care model in our group is to navigate the patient experience because these big medical systems can be daunting to patients and they don't know what to do. So our job is to connect the dots. And so I learn and I develop relationships with other providers so that we get to know each other and then I'm able to reach out, especially when there's an emergency. But, you know, referring people is a seamless operation at this point. So I think really just getting to know your colleagues as well as attending to other organs in the body.
And, you know, Dr. Williams talked about some of the screening guidelines that her specialty societies offer. So I don't know if she wanted to add anything about, you know, those referral pathways, how we can get patients over to our gastroenterology colleagues.
I think a lot of health systems have direct referral pathways. We have one where I am, meaning if someone has a stool test that's positive, we do e-consults or electronic consults that get put in and the patient gets scheduled. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, you can just directly refer someone for a colonoscopy. So that way they don't have to go for a clinic visit and they don't have to get charged. Mm-hmm. I think most health systems have that pathway. So if you find that referral pathway is very helpful. But sometimes patients will come to speak to me because they really want to get their options, you know, and a deep explanation of what their options are, the risks, the benefits, the numbers. And that does happen. It's just a regular consult. But if someone is like a high risk and they're having symptoms and someone gives me a phone call, I'll try and put that person out sooner rather than later. But I think your best bet, honestly, is the direct referral pathways that your health system might already have in place.
Right.
And that way they just go straight to colonoscopy.
Right. So there's a bunch of resources for patients, for providers that are out there. If anyone wants to plug any of those to share with our audience members, please let us know. I think at the end, we'll talk about some other ways people can get some information.
I think the GI societies, the American College of Gastroenterology has patient-facing materials. The C5, which is a New York City Colorectal Cancer Coalition, has some patient-facing materials on their website in New York City. And the great thing is they have it in different languages, Polish, Chinese, Spanish. Also, the National Colorectal Cancer Roundtable has materials. They even have a colorectal cancer guidebook for African Americans, 2023 or 2022. The CDC, a lot of these places will have online materials that are patient-facing and maybe in different languages that you can give to your patient. I think for time purposes, what may not be a bad idea is to potentially have the patient read something while they're in the waiting area on their different screening choices. So by the time they get into your office, they already have some rudimentary idea of what they're going to talk about. So the New York City C5 is a New York City Colorectal Cancer Coalition, and their mission statement states they want to partner with the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene to increase awareness and screening for colorectal cancer and adenomatous polyps in New York City men and women in order to reduce the incidence and mortality of this highly prevalent and preventable disease. So looking back historically, in 2003, the screening rates in New York City were 42%. And they were getting about 1,500 CRC deaths in New York City per year. So what happened is a host of different stakeholders who came together that included the New York City Department of Health, the C5, they're called C5 Coalition, physicians, medical societies, hospitals, local government, and they did a huge educational program where they went into different communities in New York City to really do education around colon cancer screening. And as an aside, prior to COVID in 2019, screening rates had almost equalized across all ethnicities, Black, White, Hispanic, Latino, Latinx, and Pacific Islanders. Within New York City, I think we were about 69%, somewhere between 65 to 69% across the board. Unfortunately, with COVID, things changed and the screening rates decreased and we're still working to pull those back in. But New York City C5, with the help of multiple stakeholders and also having community health workers, which make a huge difference, really made a major effort to go into certain communities and different communities and educate around colon cancer screening. And it worked over time.
Thank you so much. Thank you for that information. And I know, Michelle, the American Cancer Society has a wealth of information. I don't know if you want to share anything.
Yes, I would like to. Absolutely. The American Cancer Society, we always recommend that people go to our website. It's cancer.org. It has a plethora of information. The website can be easily changed with a click of a button, totally into Spanish. We have education materials for the patients as well as professionals on our website. You just need to go onto the website, find the information. It's very easy to locate. We always try to tell people, whether you're a professional or a patient or someone in the community, do not Google things. You know, you get a plethora of different information out there. Go to the American Cancer Society. We have so much information on there. It has been vetted. It is, you know, researched, everything on there. So just head to our website and get the information directly from the source.
Wonderful. So thank you to Michelle, to Dr. Williams, to Dr. Rosser. Key takeaways for our colleagues is that colorectal cancer is the second leading cause of cancer death among women and persons under age 50. As OBGYNs, we're often the physician that serves as a primary care provider for our patients. So it's really important that we incorporate colorectal cancer screening into our practice for every single patient. As noted, you know, inequities and disparities continue to exist. So this podcast and others are so critical to educating our members and our patients. So just to wrap up, thank you so much for all joining us. I'll throw it to each of you that if you wanted to add some final comments for our audience. So Michelle, we'll start with you. Any final thoughts for our audience members?
As both Dr. Rosser and Dr. Williams mentioned, getting screened is the best way to prevent colon cancer. We know that. As it is Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month, we want to make sure that we are touting it and letting everybody know, not only just for March, but all year long, that this is a priority, that we really want people to be screened.
Absolutely. Dr. Williams?
I think from a provider perspective, discuss with your patients colon cancer screening. We know it's preventable and it's treatable if caught very early. And again, there are multiple options. As much as I say get a colonoscopy, not everyone wants a colonoscopy, it's okay. But just give them their options so they know. I'll point them to resources such as the American Cancer Society website where they can make a decision.
Dr. Rosser.
Yeah, final thoughts are just remember to incorporate this into your regular screenings during your well woman exam. And get to know the GI people around you so that you know how to seamlessly refer patients, because the better the experience with the patient, the better adherence it will be that patient will follow through and actually have their colon cancer screening. So I think that is really important to keep in mind.
So thanks to Michelle, Dr. Williams, Dr. Rosser. Thank you for joining us for this ACOG District 2 podcast in recognition of Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month. This podcast was generously supported by an unrestricted educational grant from Exact Sciences. We'd like to get your feedback, so please tell us your thoughts by completing the evaluation that's linked in the description. And thank you so much for joining us today.
Until next time, stay connected, stay engaged, and visit us on our website at www.acogny.org for more in our podcast series.